Hello and welcome to Down to Earth, a podcast created by the environmental charity Hubbub. This season is all about fashion, because would you believe it, the fashion industry produces 10% of all carbon emissions and clothing production has roughly doubled since 2000. Alongside that, one garbage truck full of clothes is being burned or dumped in landfill every second. So we want to discover why we're buying so much and how our wardrobes impact the world around us. I'm Sarah Dyvel and I've been working in the environmental space for 7 years, but I've always been a big shopper. I love fashion and I love new clothes, and however much I learn about what the fashion industry is up to, I still find fast fashion a hard habit to break, and I find it really difficult to know how to dress sustainably. I know I'm not alone in that feeling, so I want to bring you with me as we meet the designers, experts, and changemakers who unpick why our wardrobes aren't working for us and for the planet. My guests today are Charlene Gandy and Larissa Kennedy, who are both contributors to Shadow Mag. If you haven't heard of Shadow Mag before, it's an online magazine that focuses on the front line of people fighting for social justice all across the world. They shed light on loads of different issues, but if you want to learn more about sustainable fashion, they've got loads of amazing interviews with up-and-coming designers, with garment workers, and even with Michaela Loach, who we already spoke to at the start of this podcast. And they aren't just online. They've started a book club, and this time around, it's all about fair fashion. We're going to be talking about that in a second, but first, I asked Charlene and Larissa to tell me what outfits they'd chosen for the podcast and how it made them feel.
Do you know what? Like, I'm literally in bicycle shorts right now. And this jumper that I thrifted, which is my favorite jumper, I always wear it. And to the point where, yeah, it's gonna be a hammer situation forever to keep this safe, because yeah, so I'm literally in bicycle shorts and a black jumper. Like, there is no fashionable energy here at this hour.
I am in exactly the same position. We are going for deep comfort this morning. I'm also in a thrifted fleece, and I, you know, when you've just like been on Zoom after Zoom after Zoom call and you think, God, people must think I own like literally like one of two fleeces at this point. But it's just peak comfort. It's like alpaca wool, and it just makes me feel all beautiful and cozy.
I love the outfit choices. I think that comfort is always a priority when recording a podcast. To kick things off properly, I wanted to ask you about the books that you've chosen for this round of the Shadow Mag Book Club and why you chose them.
Really, the reason that we picked fair fashion and garment workers' rights as our theme this time around for the fourth cluster of Shadow's bookshelf, which is the name of our book club, is because it's the 10-year anniversary of the Rana Plaza disaster in Bangladesh, which many folks will remember. 10 years ago, there was an absolutely devastating disaster at a garment production factory in Dhaka in Bangladesh, which I think was really the sparking point for a lot of conversations about what the fast fashion industry looks like and the sorts of labor that it exploits in order to exist today. And I think a lot of the movement sprung from what had happened at Rana Plaza. And on one hand, it feels like it only happened yesterday. On one hand, it feels like it happened so long ago and still nothing really has changed. And in fact, we've seen the rise of the ultra fast fashion movement. And so I think Rana Plaza really it pins us all to a point in time where we really started as a movement being aware of what the consequences of consuming clothing the way we do today are.
And I wonder if you could, for the people listening, how would you define the ultra fast fashion movement and where we are today?
For me, this kind of comes into the echo chambers and kind of filter bubbles that we all exist in. I had very much assumed that an incident like Rana Plaza, where thousands of garment workers were injured or died in that collapse of the factory building, I would have assumed that would have really switched people on and made them think a little bit about what their role was as consumers in that supply chain. And I think there was a certain slight shift that happened for sure. But what has become more obvious to me is that that's probably the people that I interact with and you interact with and Larissa interacts with. But by and large, there's still this movement of consumption happening that doesn't have that kind of self-awareness regard in place. So ultra fast fashion really is taking fast fashion and amping it up a little bit. It's quite literally that, you know, it's this cycle of producing clothing that is actually extraordinarily alarming for a price that is extraordinarily alarming as well. So really, with the business models of fast fashion, you're looking at say you're looking at £10 for a certain garment. The model that ultra fast fashion is relying on is undercutting all of those prices. £10 for a garment is already incredibly low if you think about the cost of materials, labor, transportation, etc., etc. You're then undercutting that price and coming in at about £3, £4, £5. So you can then imagine you've then taken a sliver away from the materials, you've taken a sliver away from the labor, and maybe a sliver away from the transportation cost. But obviously the very, very human impact of that is a sliver that's taken away from labor. So we look at brands today that are really churning clothing out at a really, really alarming rate. And what that leads to is I think on the consumer's part as well, a lack of appreciation about what has gone into producing that garment, the effort, the environmental impact, the labor impact, the cost and the emissions to get it to you. So what's happening in the ultra fast fashion industry is that people are consuming at a very alarming rate because there's just that fragmented relationship with the clothing and with the item itself.
It made me think of the £1 bikini that came out a couple of years ago. But that being, I think, a great example of what you're describing is suddenly if people are like, oh, great, you could buy a bikini for £1. I imagine it's a lot easier to throw that item away if you've paid such a low price for it. But yeah, I think that undercutting and low prices becoming normal, I think people are probably starting to expect lower prices on their clothes because, you know, you can get it cheaper in certain places. So I wanted to ask you about the books that you've chosen for this book club and what particular angle of sustainable fashion they were talking about that interested you.
Absolutely. So there are three books. Usually what we do at Shadows Bookshelf is we pick one fiction text, one non-fiction text, and one memoir. Books don't always fit very neatly into those categories, but so that everybody has a chance to read something that really fits with their reading style as well. And what we also do at the book club is we don't mandate that everybody reads the full book. So what we'll do ahead of time is send a handful of extracts, a handful of chapters, and then discuss those. And then obviously if folks want to go away and read the full book, they are more than welcome to. With the cluster on fair fashion and garment workers' rights, we've got three phenomenal books that we'll be reading between May and July. The first one is Arja Barber's Consumed, which really goes into the colonial and exploitative and extractive roots of an industry like fast fashion and why fast fashion became a permutation of the capitalist system that has been historically relying on the labor of brown and black bodies. And, you know, relying on extracting resources from land and nature in a way that has pillaged from communities for so long. So Barber does a fantastic job of kind of pinning us in that historical context and then looking at how fast fashion today is very inextricably linked to that historical context. The fiction book that we'll be looking at is A Harvest of Thorns by Corbin Addison, which is basically following a garment worker and a human rights lawyer and what their kind of experience is of navigating that world and how gruesome it is. And that is truly a reality of, you know, we've seen so many case studies come to light in recent years, especially following Rana Plaza. So it's fantastic, I think, that there is a fiction book dedicated to this particular awareness of this issue as well. And the final book, which really I think is such a seminal text, not just for talking about fair fashion and garment workers' rights, but for anti-capitalism overall, is Naomi Klein's No Logo. It's a feat of a book. I don't know whether anyone has had a chance to read it before, but if you have, you'll know that Klein goes from, you know, she just travels all over the world talking to people who make the things that we consume in the West and what those conditions are that they are making those items in. And so No Logo will really be the text that we finish on, just again to emphasize that labor rights are not exempt from the movement overall. They're not exempt from climate justice. And, you know, they're not exempt from the anti-capitalist movement. They're not exempt from how greenwashing presents itself as well. So those are the three texts that we'll be exploring.
And do you find with the kind of people coming to Shadow Mag to learn more about sustainable fashion, is transparency what they're primarily interested in? Is workers' rights what they're primarily interested in? What do you think are kind of the topics that people want to know the most about?
A lot of people see things like transparency as a means to an end, whereas the real interest is in the outcome, right? So it's about workers' rights. It's about what does that mean in real terms on a day-to-day life of the person whose labour is making this possible. So I think ultimately people do have that deeper interest, that personal interest, to know that there isn't going to be, a woman of colour on the other end who, yeah, we might be hearing a transparent reality of, you know, X, Y, and Z thing about this piece of clothing, but has the reality actually changed? And I think, you know, going back to what we were saying earlier about the Rana Plaza disaster, what is so striking is how little has changed in 10 years. I think another one of those moments that people often then think, you know, how can we have seen so little change is the expose around the dark factory in Leicester and garment workers being paid, you know, just around £3, workers being forced to work during lockdowns around the COVID pandemic. Like all of these things, I think people, yes, they care about the instance. Yes, they care about the story in that moment, whether that's transparency, whether that's, people, what their situation is in that moment. But ultimately, I think when people come to care about these situations, it's because there's a deeper concern for workers' rights, for, worker exploitation, for resource exploitation, and what that means in the long term. I do think it runs deeper.
I think also there is... We talk about systems change, and we often try and weigh up with individual action. And, you know, Larissa will know there's so much back and forth about what the, like, quote unquote, best thing is to do. Do you, you know, change your individual actions, or do you try and change an entire system? And I don't know the answer to that, to be honest. I think if I were to give my honest view on that, it is that individual action is a cog. And if there are enough cogs whirring, then there is potential for system change. And I think that's really why people come to Shadow to learn, as well as, you know, what is our role? We don't exist in silos, right? There's a brilliant quote that I cannot remember for the life of me where I read, but it just in various contexts kind of, I think, rings true. And it's, we are each other's liberation. And I think in this context in particular, we are each other's liberation is a fantastic way to emphasize that we are not removed from the person that is picking the cotton, you know, that makes the t-shirt. We're not removed from the person who is sewing that t-shirt. We're not removed from the person who is packing it. Our hands have quite physically, literally touched that t-shirt. And I think if we remember the tangibility of that, that is a reason, again, that people are coming to learn and coming to understand what their role is in facilitating this industry, and in facilitating that, in allowing for change to happen in the industry as well.
I love that. And I think it's a really beautiful barrier to the apathy that it can be quite easy to feel when there is loads of information. It feels like you can't really make a change because the machine is so big. But actually thinking about how we are all connected to each other, and we also all have a power and a responsibility to look out for each other, to try and make a decision that's not just best for you, but best for a collective.
Absolutely. And I feel like that also goes back to how do we then shift this conversation from, yes, it's so important to take individual responsibility, but then how do we see that as part of something bigger? And I think, again, that comes back to unions and collective bargaining. We're talking about workers' rights in the UK. We're not talking about workers' rights more generally. But I think fast fashion is one of those conversations that forces us to see those things as connected, because often when we're talking about, you know, needing to resort to fast fashion, it's because people are talking about the cost of living crisis, or they're talking about not having enough money to pay for garments that have been resourced in an ethical way. So how do we show people that, you know, wanting fair pay for workers in the UK so that they can, you know, buy clothing that is sourced sustainably is absolutely interconnected with workers' rights in the global south, and particularly in spaces where those garments are being made. Because if we are able to see our struggles as interconnected, I think it stops that dehumanization process. So I think it's definitely incumbent upon us as a movement to start talking about those things as inherently interlinked. And I don't think we've kind of made that connection as strongly as we can yet.
And I think this would be a good place actually to ask you, it's the last question we ask everyone, and I don't want to have to ask you to narrow it down, but I'm going to do a question to both of you, what you think one thing that the fashion industry could do tomorrow to make the biggest impact is, and what you think one thing that everyone listening at home could do today to make the biggest impact to create a more sustainable, fair fashion industry.
I think one thing that companies could start to do and the industry could start to do is quite simply pay people appropriately, pay them a fair wage. We hear so many arguments of, well, that's a fair wage for the country they're living in. That does not matter. And on top of a fair wage, what are working conditions? How much space are people getting to take leave to visit their families at home? And, you know, in a lot of the things that we haven't talked about, for instance, that people move in the global south, people generally move to urban environments to take up factory jobs, which means that they leave elderly parents and kids behind in villages. How are we making sure that the conditions for people to thrive at work really exist? I think that's a conversation that isn't being had. Even if we're paying people the right amount of money, if you're then making them work 10, 12 hours with very little humane condition, that money actually doesn't matter at all. So it's a very, very, very simple thing, I think, that that companies can start doing and that they have shied away from doing because the business model doesn't work in their favor. I think for people, again, a relatively easy thing, but challenging to kind of set a habit. And, you know, I think those of us who have quit fast fashion, I quit it about 5 years ago now. It's a process. It does not happen overnight, but it's just about forming a new habit and really looking at a piece of clothing and going, who touched this? You know, who are all of the people that had a hand in getting this piece of clothing to me today? And being active in your consumption, you know, shopping is an activity in the West, which I think elsewhere in the world is even like a bizarre concept, right? So we are so removed from everything that we buy, be that food or clothing or technology or furniture even. And really being active in your consumption it requires switching your brain on a little bit. So that would be my one takeaway for people is look at a thing, an object that you are buying, and take 30 seconds quite literally to even be grateful for all the hands that went into getting it to you today.
Okay, so in terms of the industry, I completely agree that this has to be about wages. And the thing that I would add to what Charlene said is, I think the industry reasonably could be looking towards workers' cooperatives for resourcing garments. Like if we're actually centering the voices of those who are making our clothing, then I think cooperatives are such a positive way to go, because it completely challenges the fast fashion sweatshop production of the way that things are done now, because this is about workers' rights directly in how things are being run, because it's co-owned by those workers. So I think cooperatives in the industry sourcing from cooperatives would be a really, really positive thing that they could conceivably do, like, tomorrow. So if I had anything that I could say to the industry to just do tomorrow, it would be making sure that workers actually have an active voice, not only to say what needs to be done, but to have that done. So I love cooperatives and sourcing my clothes from cooperatives, which is why that leads me on to what people can do. And that's just being creative about our fashion. I think one of the things that I really try to do as an active consumer is thinking about, you know, how I can be creative with the garments that I already own. And like, can I turn a skirt into a top? Can I turn a skirt into a dress? Can I turn a shirt into a jacket? Like, really just trying to think about my wardrobe differently. Because I think often we are caught in the, as one of the cogs in the capitalist wheel, as Charlene has said, like, I think we're often caught in the crisis of being forced into overconsumption. Like, do we really need more garments? Like, I look back in my nan's closet, and, you know, at 90 years old, she was wearing things that she'd bought in her 40s, in her 50s, in her 60s, and these were things that stood the test of time. She also at one point was a sewer and a seamstress herself, and really instilled in me the idea that, you know, fashion and being creative with fashion and what you already have is really, really important. So if someone is thinking about how they can step away from the fast fashion hellscape, I would definitely say think about the garments that you have, not only just you, but also in your community, whether that's your friends, your siblings. Like, how can you make those garments that are already in your sphere of existence, you know, how can you give them a new life and appreciate them a little bit more?
Thanks so much for listening, everyone. I hope that you enjoyed my chat with Charlene and Larissa. I loved meeting them so much, and I really loved being able to go through Shadow Mag and hear more from their contributors and editors. They've got some really amazing articles, so I'd recommend that you go and check them out. And if you want to read along with their book club at home, we'll make sure that we put all the links in the description. If you've been inspired to make a change, or if you're already making one, we would love to hear about it. You can find me on my email, sarah@hubup.org.uk, or you can find us on all the usual socials. And if you're quick enough, we might even read it out on the next episode. Thank you so much for listening. This podcast was presented by me, Sarah Dyvel, created by Hubup, and produced by Ellie J.